Okay, let's start. Good afternoon and welcome to the end of week four. This is the second lecture on phonetics and phonology. And I know from the tutorial teachers that a few of the concepts which I introduced last time were not 100% clear. I will revise one or two of those today. I'm going to introduce the concept of phoneme again as opposed to phone. Okay. I'm going to start doing that, so you're going to get more on phonology. I'm not going to tell you more on different sounds as such. That's what we did last time. I'll then do a bit of a detour where I'll be telling you something about syllables and syllable structures. This is something that you'll hear again in the fifth term in 2 years' time, in a bit more detail. This is not something that I will place great emphasis on. It's a bit of a detour where you can sit back, and if you feel that this is too advanced, then you don't have to worry. Okay. After that, I'll say something about connected speech. That's when you have to start worrying again. Okay. That's when, I'm going to say things that are more important. Okay, we're not repeating last week's exercise, okay? But, I don't have to say more, I think. Right? Okay, I'm going to give you more detail than just the basics in this lecture. But I will let you know throughout the lecture if I can, but also towards the end what the really important bits are. Okay, so, before I do that, just a few organizational matters. And in fact, this may actually be a little bit of a short lecture. I may let you go 10 minutes early today. We'll see. In return, I want a quiet audience. Okay? Okay. Before going into linguistics, I'd like to tell you that I asked a few weeks back whether you would like to have an introduction to the library, which is more than just a general introduction to the library as such. I mean, this is where the books are and this is where you take out books, but more sort of geared towards you as students of English. Okay. It will be done by Mr. Wessel, who is the person in charge of English and a few other things. And there are three dates for this. I had the impression that there were about sort of 70 to 80 people on the whole who might be interested in this. And I've got three dates for you in rooms that can hold about 25 people. So it should just about work out unless everyone goes at the same time. Okay. So this is these are the three dates. Tuesdays, Mondays, and one Tuesday, one Monday and one Thursday, on the 22nd of November, the 28th of November, and the 1st of December. Okay. Always from 6 to 8. I know this clashes with some of the tutorials. This may clash with something else that you're doing. But I felt if I give you three different dates, then it's going to somehow even out a little bit. Okay. It's going to take place in the library, and there is a particular room for this, the so-called Schulungsraum, which is on the ground floor, which is near the general sort of information counter. Okay. And because this happens a bit later this year than last year, I've also decided that I'm going to postpone the library assignment until after that. Okay. So if it says, I got a few emails from worried students who said, what is this assignment, or whatever. They quite clearly haven't listened to the lectures yet. Which is your choice. You can do this whenever you want to do this, but anyway. I had to tell them, yes, it's postponed. Okay, this was the initial plan, but it was a preliminary schedule. Okay, that's the first organizational matter. I will tell you a little bit more about the exam next week. There is a new group of people doing the exams as opposed to last year. We still have to settle a few final points, and I hope to be able to tell you a bit more about the outline. I'll give you a typical exam also, a few exam questions. For example, questions about phonetics. Next week we'll do morphology, so you'll get the kind of questions that I've asked before on those occasions. Finally, I'd like to make a point that there are readings associated with each lecture. And I did mention this in the first lecture, and I'm not going to every week just sort of announce what the reading is. I'm going to assume that you're looking at the schedule, which is available on StudIP, and you're doing this, well, not on your own necessarily, you can do this together with other people, but without me telling you that you have to read pages 50 to 55 or something like that. I am aware, and that is actually my fault at the moment, I am aware that I have not uploaded the readings, the pages for the new Finnegan, for the latest edition. Can I just have a show of hand? Who is using the very latest edition of Finnegan? Okay, apologies to those. I haven't received my own copy yet, but something happened there that shouldn't have happened. But anyway, to cut the long story short, I'm trying to do this by next week so that you can also see what pages are required. Basically, not all that much changes, but it's not the same. Is that a question? Or? You can, without any problem, work with the fifth edition, absolutely. If you find a second-hand copy of the fourth edition, then that's fine as well. Okay. I wouldn't go back beyond that. Okay. And the most recent one is the sixth edition, and that's obviously fine as well. But, I mean, as you can tell, I haven't got a copy of that myself yet. As you will have noticed, my lectures are not just a repetition of what's in Finnegan. So I obviously check what's there as well, but I have my own views of what's important, and I'm adding to this, and I'm trying to complement this. So that's why it's not a major issue which edition you use. It's just important that you use one of those editions. Okay? Good. Any other organizational questions? Anything else that needs clarifications? Clarification. No. Okay. Then let's do some linguistics. Okay. What did we do last time? It was really funny. Last time after the lecture, two people came up here and said, till today I thought linguistics was going to be easy. Yes, I know. I threw quite a few things at you, quite a lot of terminology. I do realize that there is massive sort of input to take in and make sense of. Don't sort of get into a frenzy where you think this is all too much. There is a system behind quite a few things which you will then again discover in different levels of linguistic description. For example, the distinction between phoneme and phone, or between phone and phoneme, will be very, very similar. Well, once you've understood this, then you will understand something important in morphology, namely the difference between a morph and a morpheme. Okay, we'll talk about that next week. So it may seem a lot in each lecture, but in some way it's also, well, not the same, but something very similar, and that's one of the things I would like you to notice, that there's actually a system which works on different levels. Okay. Yes, I realize it may be a bit much in some ways. It's in a different language than what you speak at home, etc. But hey, this is university. So, yes. Okay. What did we do last time? I described all of the sounds that are relevant for English. Okay? There are many other sounds around in other languages, but we focus on those. Okay? And the important bit, and that this is really something that you need to be able to handle, both actively and passively, is that we looked at the different ways in which the sounds can, well, are produced. The different ways in the sense of where they are produced, the place of articulation, and how they are produced, as in manner of articulation. This is about the consonants. Okay? And also in the context of consonants, whether it's voiced or not. We also looked at some of the vowel qualities, whether it's front or back and closed, etc. Also length, okay? Those kind of aspects. These are features, the sort of the physical features of sounds. Well, it's not actually the physical features of sounds, but how we produce the sounds of English using the articulatory elements in our mouth, okay? The elements that we have to produce sounds. Okay. I also introduced you to the IPA, the International Phonetic Alphabet. And I realized that there are lots of, I mean, the chart which I uploaded is actually more complicated than what I introduced last time. There are some diacritic symbols on it. There are lots of things on it which I did not discuss and which are much more detailed than what you need at the moment. What is important for you at the moment is the very top for the consonants. And it is ordered according to the exact same criteria or elements of the articulatory system which I introduced. And it goes from front to back, and it goes from plosive to fully open. So look at the system, try to understand the system, and then it'll actually be much easier than it looks at first sight. Okay? And remember, if there are two signs in one of the cells, that means one of them is voiced and the other one is voiceless. Okay? Right. As I said, I only focused on the sounds relevant for English, but then I also talked a little bit about other languages because I had to introduce the difference between phonetics and phonology. And this is where I'm going to start now. One last thing before I do this is that I showed you this trapezium, the vowel trapezium last time, where I placed all the different vowels on the schema, and I explained it to you, but I thought I'll show you the same one again with the footnotes for the vowel names, so to speak. I mean, the struct vowel, for example, has a 2 here as a footnote, and it says the vowel is absent for most speakers in the north of England, who instead use the struct vowel. Okay, I did say that in the lecture, but I felt it was useful perhaps to give this to you on a slide as well. Good. Okay. A bit of revision. I introduced the concept of a minimal pair. And I've got 2 minimal pairs for you here. Can you, for 30 seconds among yourselves, think about why these are minimal pairs, what they sound like, write the words down in standard English, I mean in the sense of using the graphemes of English, not in the phonetic transcription, and then maybe think about why they are minimal pairs. Okay, has everyone got them? You can, in a way, already see that they're minimal pairs without actually realizing realizing which actual words they are, because the difference between those two sets only lies with a single symbol, with one of the IPA symbols. In this case, it's the first one, and in this case, it's the first one as well. Okay. So what are those two words? We've got team versus dean, okay, and thigh versus an old-fashioned way of using a pronoun, thy. Okay, thy name. Okay, your name. Okay. And in fact, we might even have something like minimal sets. Okay, it's basically the same thing. It's just that there is a whole set of words where one single sound differs. And then, well, what does it do? It makes it possible to distinguish between two meanings. Okay. Not time. Oh, I've got the same one here again. Team and deem are not the same word in English. Okay. They may be in some other language, even though they sound different. Okay. So the procedure can be used, and this is straight from the slide, to establish that, for example, voice and voiceless stops are phonemes in English. This means that whether you use a voiceless stop at the beginning of a word, for example, or a voiced stop, can potentially result in two different words. Okay. They are meaning distinguishing elements. Okay? Here's a definition for you. A phoneme is the smallest meaning distinguishing unit of a language. They do not mean anything on their own. P doesn't mean anything. Or the difference between p and b, voiced and voiceless, doesn't mean anything. But if it is used in a minimal pair, it will create a meaning difference in the words that are produced. Now, we also saw that phonemes can be realized in different ways. Everyone remember what I mean by this? Well, I'll come back to that in a minute, but I said that the phonemes can be realized, for example, with aspiration or without aspiration. I gave the example of the p sound, which can be p, p, right? I mean, I'm overdoing this now. Or it can just be, I mean, I can't even do this without, well, p, as in without aspiration. The second one, yeah, it only works within a word, really. Okay. I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, these different realizations are nothing more than different realizations of the same thing, meaning that if you produce those sounds, those different sounds, you will not be able to produce words or sets of words that have different meanings. Whether you say the P with aspiration or without aspiration, will never ever, in English, produce two different words. And there are reasons why a P might be aspirated or not, and we looked at that, and we're going to look at that again today. This is why Finnegan calls his chapter Sounds in the Mind. Because these are actually different sounds. But for the mind that speaks English, for example, for the English mind, they are interpreted as the same thing. The same thing in different contexts, perhaps, okay, but still the same thing. If you have a different mind, or let's say differently, if you speak a different language, then the same sounds may in fact be parts of different phonemes and therefore create differences in meaning. Okay? I'll give you some more examples of that in a minute. What we've done so far has been sort of a very broad phonetic description in many ways. I did introduce the diacritic for aspiration. Okay? So, for example, we called p the bilabial voiceless plosive. But we've already seen that we could show the different variants of the same sound in English in two ways, with aspiration and without aspiration, and that's when it's no longer a broad phonetic transcription. And that's how we indicate that these, or that's what we need to do if we want to show the allophonic status of this. Okay? Meaning allophones, remember allophones, two allophones are realizations of the same phoneme. More of that again later. So, I've already said this, just to see it in writing again. The aspirated and the non-aspirated version of P cannot produce minimal pairs of English, so they are allophones of the phoneme P. There are other languages where this is not the case, where they are not allophones. Now, what determines whether the P is aspirated or not? Well, the first one is at the beginning. Where is it? We've got pit versus spit. The P in pit is at the beginning of the words, and in fact at the beginning of the syllable. While in spit, it's the second grapheme, it's the second sound, and that results in the non-aspiration. Okay. So, the position is important. I wanted to quickly talk about something that Finnegan also mentions, to look at this in a little bit more detail. This is straight out of Finnegan. Is the position, in the case of aspiration, really sufficient to explain things? This is from, in the fifth edition, page 109 of Finnegan. If you have read this already, then maybe you can find this very quickly. If you haven't read this yet, try and work out why the P in pedigree and personal and persecute, etc., is aspirative. Here in petunia and paternal and peninsula, it is also aspirated. Emporium, also aspirated, but here it isn't. I'll give you a minute to think about that. It has to do with the fact, with something that I colored red here. What did I color? I colored those syllables which receive primary stress. Okay, and the last one, rapid. There is no stress on the syllable containing the bilabial closure of P. Okay? But here neither. Yeah? You're absolutely right. But the difference is that it's actually two facts. I mean, it's not the difference, but it's a combination of two things. This is a case where the bilabial plosive occurs word initially, even in a non-stressed syllable. In cases like this, it is aspirated. Here we have it non-word initially, but in a stressed syllable, aspirated. Here we have it in a non-word initial syllable, and in a unstressed syllable, and it is not aspirated. So sometimes it actually gets quite complicated, and that's just two factors. But there are rules about this, and it's systematic. Okay. Also notice, you can say, let me try to do this. You can do pit and spit, but you can't do pit and spit. Okay, yeah, it's very difficult to do this. Yeah? What does this mean? It means that these realizations, because they depend on the position in the word and in the syllable, are actually systematic, rule-based, which means that their distribution is some kind of either-or. This is what the phonetician calls, or the person doing phonetics and phonology, complementary distribution. Okay. It's either this or that, but not a question of choice. Okay. This is the sort of traditional and typical case of allophones, okay, where it really depends on the situation, the place. I hear lots of chatting again going on in that corner. This is my favorite corner here, right? Just don't, please. Okay? Or if you do, just leave. Now, sometimes this is not the case where we have variation, but it's the same position. For example, the word mop. We can say mop, or we can not release the air. There is no audible release. We can say mop. And this actually, some people call a case where the variation is actually free, meaning it's not determined by the position in the word. Yeah. Remember that last week I introduced the glottal stop and T as allophones of the phoneme T. And I already said that a few people, that people disagree about this. This is not a case of complementary distribution. It's not that depending on where in the word it is, you have to use a glottal stop. Or all speakers of this particular dialect or accent or whatever use a glottal stop. So it depends on other factors. Is this free variation? Well, free variation in the terms of structure of words and syllables, yes. But there is an additional factor, or in fact a whole range of additional factors, which are social class, age, region, etc., etc. This is what you're going to talk about in the second term when you're doing social linguistics. Okay? Good. Let's look at a few more allophones, or allophone pairs, or realizations of different realizations of phonemes. Are the L's produced in the same way here? And if not, well, if I'm asking like that, you can sort of assume they're not. But if not, why not? You can try it out yourself. It's okay. You can make noise. Now you can. Yeah. Do you agree that there is a small difference? Do you agree that the L's are not produced in exactly the same way? In fact, if you say two words following each other very quickly, then you will see that your tongue actually does something different. Yes? So that has an impact on L?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have a look. Okay, we've got, I'm not sure we mean the same thing, but let's see. Okay, we have milk, wealth, okay, calls, and seldom. Okay, and we've got leak, and look, and asleep. I'm not saying that there may be an additional small difference because of the different vowels and the way the mouth is shaped differently, but I think there is a more noticeable difference. Try to say milk in the same way as leak. Milk? No, it's milk. Milk. Yeah? Ooh, ooh. Yeah? What's this? This is a so-called dark O. As opposed to a clear L. Yeah. It's as if the tongue has a slightly different position in the mouth. Okay? Now, this is a term that you do not need to learn. Okay? But this is called velarization. Now, even though you don't need to learn this term by heart and be able to apply it, I think it makes sense because it describes what's happening. There is something happening to the tongue which has to do with the velum. Well, with the position of the velum. If you think about, well, if you try it out, milk, then the tongue sort of moves up slightly towards the velum. All right? So, it depends on whether it follows a vowel or not. Right, here we only had one phoneme that is involved. Okay. Are there any differences between the first sounds of teeth and tool, and peel and pool, and kill and call? Mm-hmm. Yeah, aspiration comes in again. Okay, tool, teeth. But you don't think that tool is aspirated?
Yes, but
This is not the issue. You're right, with teeth and tool we do have an aspirated t, yes. But there is something else that slightly changes. If you say teeth and tool, what changes? Yeah. Uh-huh.
The lips. The lips are rounded.
Yes.
They are
exactly. Yes. And this is because the second word. The second word. The second word in this contains a rounded vowel, and how you produce the rounded vowel has an effect on the preceding consonant. Yeah? So it influences that. Now, you absolutely correctly said it's got to do with the lips. Before we called it velarization, if the tongue is slightly raised towards the velum. So what are we going to call this process? Labialization. Okay. Sort of makes sense. It's again, this is a term which I don't expect you to know, but I wanted to show you the system of all of this. Okay. If we want to use a sort of more delicate phonetic transcription, then we can show this difference. And here we're not even talking about aspiration. We could add this as well, I guess. That this is actually one without rounded lips, and this one is a labialized teeth. And there is a rule. The rule says that every consonant preceding a rounded vowel will be influenced by the rounded vowel. Okay. But, and this is the important bit to take home, both the rounded consonants and their unrounded counterparts are the same thing. Well, are part of the same phoneme. They are not the same thing. They are two different sounds, but in our minds, we make them into the same thing, namely, well, t, the phoneme t. But they are allophones. Is the concept of allophones and phoneme becoming slightly clearer? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. And you can also see why this happens. This is some kind of, I mean, you will have probably heard of the concept of assimilation. Okay. You sort of see, or of in, yeah, it import, it has an influence on what follows each other. Okay. Here is another case that's quite interesting. Whoops. Whoops, 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 whoops. Okay. How do you transcribe the word open? You can try this out. I'll give you 25 seconds. Try to transcribe open. Okay, did you have something like this? Well, those of you who said no, that's fine, because you could actually do it differently. I hope those of you who said no, that's something else like this. Probably no either, right? Yeah. But what is this? Well, how, try to say open 3 or 4 times one after the other. Open, 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 open. Yeah. Do you actually produce and then again o? No, you don't. You say hmm, right? You basically have a, well, you close your lips. And during the n part of the word, the lips are still closed. Oh, hmm, yes. I see some people still debating whether that's true. Again, this is something that you do not need to learn for the exam, but I think it makes sense to call this a syllabic nasal. Okay? It takes the position of a syllable. Okay? It's a word final nasal that follows another consonant. You do this all the time in German. Haben. Haben. Yeah? You don't say haben. Yeah. And you're not vernünftig, but you're vernünftig. Yeah? Or unvernünftig. Okay? You'll get a break in about 5 minutes or so, so don't worry. Okay, we talked last time about the fact that vowels can be short or long. Okay. Long vowels and diphthongs, remember, where we have a movement in the vowel, okay, they in a way belong to the same natural class. Okay. But having talked about different realizations of sounds, or different sounds being different realizations of the same thing, the question arises whether vowel length is contrastive in English. Meaning, if the only thing that I change is the length of the vowel, but I do not change the quality of the vowel, can you produce a minimal pair? So something like God and God. Well, no, it's very, very difficult to do this. Why is it difficult to do this? Because the answer is no. Okay? And it's always difficult to do the things that are not part of your phonemic system. Yeah? That's why the Spanish find it difficult to talk about vowels and vowels. Okay? Because the b and the v are p- part of their phonetic setup or of the kind of sounds that they use, but they don't, they're part of the same phoneme. Okay. But vowel length is not random. Okay. Again, this is something slightly more specific, but it all ties in with the general principles. You can say wing, bang, strength, and hung. They're all short vowels. Okay? You can't say wing. You don't have barn and strength or something like that, and hern. Okay? Why? Well, because in front of hmm, okay, vowels must be short. Okay? I'm only showing this to you because I want to get across that there is a system, and the system sort of holds together, well, it hangs together on various parts of what we do with our mouths, basically. Okay. Let's look at this. Well, or maybe even that's something different. We have C, bar, la, law, and strength. Yeah, okay. Do you want to change? Okay. And strength. Okay. What do we have? Long vowels. Okay. We don't have C, ba, lo, and stre. Okay. But we have sip, bat, lock, and stress. Why? Well, because these are all monosyllabic words. They only have one syllable. They're in fact content words. So there are nouns, okay, for example. And if they have open syllables, what does it mean? When there is no consonant following the vowel in the syllable. We come to syllables in a minute. So C is an open syllable. Okay. Then that's okay. But the short vowel is only possible in a closed syllable when a consonant is added. Okay, these were all a number of minor rules in the sense of that I do not expect them as part of your active knowledge. There is one very important rule in English. Yeah. Now, many vowels, this is phrased in a too extreme fashion. Okay, but the vowel in unstressed syllable typically or very often becomes schwa. There are also short vowels, short unstressed vowels like I that don't have to become a schwa. But many, many vowels become a schwa. Remember from last time the schwa is the lazy vowel, the one where you just basically barely open your mouth and say, ugh. You don't do anything with your tongue, you don't lower your chin, you don't do anything, you just say, ugh. Okay. The most frequent vowel in English. Okay. So, photography versus photograph, or actually it's the other way around. Photograph versus photography. Library versus librarian. Library versus librarian. So, I don't ask you to transcribe those now because you'll get a chance to do something else in a few minutes. So we've got photograph versus photography. So we've got the diphthong here turning sort of in a way to a, well, it's in this, in the noun, it is actually a schwa. Or here, library versus librarian. Library. Okay. Okay. Now, I've made the point repeatedly that this is language specific. This is something, well, as I said, in our minds because we acquire the skills of distinguishing between sounds as part of our language. Different languages may have different phonemes, or they may have the same phones, the same sounds, but sort of distribute them differently across the phonemic system. For example, German speakers have problems differentiating in English between kids and kits. Because there is a rule in English, in German, that the Auslaut is verhärtet. And I keep forgetting the English word for that. Terminal consonant something, I can't remember now. Okay, Auslaut verhärtet. As a result of this, in situations in English where there is a distinction, depending on whether it is voiced or not, Germans find it difficult to do this because it's not really part of their system. Okay? Or, if you do not, or no longer, belong to the few people in Germany who talk about Yachts, which my grandfather still used to do, okay, then you probably talk of Chass, or something like Chass. I can't do this because I speak English too often. Yeah, but what's the problem here? It's of course jazz, j, j. Now the j, the voice, yeah, the voiced version of this fricative is not part of the phonemic system of German. And the affricate j, as a result of that, also not. That's why because you study English, but many German speakers of English will produce a sound which is different from what you would expect from a native speaker. No. The English, on the other hand, have problems with words like tsar or tsunami. No. They talk about tsars and tsunamis and Zurich rather than Zurich. No. Because they just simply don't have the combination to in this particular position. They can talk about cats, no problem, but they can't talk about tsunamis because it's not part of their system. Okay. Try to get an English speaker to pronounce München. Yeah. Doesn't work. Okay. Now you know why. Okay. Now, of course, not only different languages have different phonemic rules, it's also dialects, okay, or accents. And I've given you largely or mostly examples from Standard British English, or Southern Standard British English, SSBE, or RP, which refers to received pronunciation, okay, which is actually an accent that very, very few people nowadays speak. Okay. A few words about American English. It has fewer diphthongs than standard British English. Okay. Do you know why? Why is ear, air, oor, and or not part of standard American English? Well, because American English is what's called a rhotic accent. A rhotic dialect. Well, it's a rhotic accent, yes. Yeah. What does it mean? Most American speakers, with very few exceptions, produce the R at the end, after a vowel, a post-vocalic R. So they don't talk about cars, they talk about cars, right? Yeah. So, fear is not fear in American English, but something like, this is difficult to see. This is actually an E with sort of a little squiggly, which looks a little bit like an R. Okay. This is one way of doing this in IPA. You might also find in the literature some kind of superscript R, and I think this is how Bill Argent, for example, does it. Okay, but the point is that this is actually some kind of, it's not a diphthong anymore, but it's basically a monophthong with sort of an R quality added to it. And this is different from the very clear diphthong that we have in British English. This has to do with the history of English and how the post-vocalic R has been lost in most of Britain. There are some areas still, like for example parts of Lancashire and also in Cornwall, etc., where you have the post-vocalic R, and in most parts of American English or of America you find the rhotic version. Okay. So that's why the vowel system is actually quite different in the two systems. Okay. So for example, and I'm speeding up a little here because I'm getting a little bit worried that I might not actually be able to let you off a bit early. But let's see. Okay. What's the difference between the vowels, only the vowels, in those two words in British English? The point is, there is no difference. They're the same. What's the difference between, and that's because one is pronounced in a rhotic accent rather than the other one. Now this one is also interesting. What's the difference between ladder and latter, I'm overdoing things here, in American English? Again, none. Well, more so than before, it's not just that the vowel is the same. The word is pronounced in the same way. The two words ladder and latter are not minimal pairs in American English. This is because of the so-called North American tap, okay, where the T is no longer sort of a clear-cut plosive. I introduced this already last time, but it's sort of a very quick flap, sort of a tap. What does this mean? It means that two words which are different or which produce a minimal pair in British English are no longer a minimal pair, which means, this is a bit of a fancy way of expressing this, we have a neutralization of a phonemic contrast. Okay? If you understand this last bit, then you've understood enough from the past two lectures. If you haven't understood why this is a neutralization of phonemic contrast, go back to it and see whether you can work it out. Okay? Okay, few minutes break in the sense of, no, you can't go and have a coffee, but I'll give you a few minutes of a breather where you can practice your transcription skills. As I said, you do not need to transcribe in the exam, so you're practicing something now that you do not actually actively need to do, but it helps. Okay, before it gets too loud, let's reconvene. Okay? Now, these are five words which allow me to say a few things extra. But, as I said, it was also a way for you to practice things if you wanted to practice. Now, with table, we actually have an interesting situation, because the question here is it, well, do we have a schwa or not? Okay. A schwa as in bill? Or is it actually, again, sort of a consonant which has a syllabic function or feel? Or yeah. And this is actually what most people would do. I've been told I'm not a phonetician myself. I'm not a specialist in phonetics and phonology, as I said. But I've asked a few people and they've all told me that they would transcribe table in this way, even though you could sort of say that there is a, between the b and the l, there is some kind of schwa. Okay? But as in open, okay, where the m had a syllabic character, the l is syllabic. Okay? Now, how did you transcribe water? You could have done this at least in two different ways. Okay? Depending on whether you wanted to use a glottal stop or not. And this is again British English. Now, how do you transcribe laugh? Well, this is one way of doing it. It's a long vowel, so you've got the two dots here to lengthen the vowel. But in fact, if you were an inhabitant of Lancaster or other places up in the north, then you wouldn't say laugh, but you would say laugh. Okay? And I talk about castles rather than castles. Okay? Because that's the way people in the north speak. Okay? Now, there and fur are also quite interesting in this respect. This would be the way to do it in RP or in Southern Standard British English. There, and well, I've actually made it more rhotic now, but there, okay? And fur, okay? Fur, yeah, okay. But if you were a Northern person, you would actually say the two words with exactly the same vowel, okay? So, you would say fur, but you would also say the. Well, I can't do this because I never learnt this when I was up north. Okay? But I have a few colleagues up in Lancaster who make absolutely no distinction in the sounds of, well, those two, and that's typical of the northern dialect. Okay. Now this quick detour to syllables. Okay. And I'll speed up here a little bit before talking about connected speech. Of course we have syllables, no, sorry, of course we have words. Can we have, please, some quiet here again? Remember, the idea is that you listen to me and not that I listen to you. Okay? Or at least you let those people who want to listen to me and leave if you want to chat. Do I have to say it in every single lecture or don't I? Okay? I feel increasingly silly having to say this. Okay. I will continue saying it. Or take other drastic action. But this is not school. Okay. We have monosyllabic words and we have polysyllabic words. Yeah, okay, we have words with only one syllable and one and words with several. Understand and sending are, of course, polysyllabic words. How many syllables? And where are the syllable boundaries? Well, with sending, where are the syllable boundaries in English? Is it sending or sending or sending? Yeah, you sort of think, you have some feeling about this. It's, you probably most would agree that this is what it is. But why is that so? Are there any rules? Are there any regularities? Yes, of course there are rules, and we can look at this in a bit more detail if we look at the structure of syllables. And that will then also make sense in this, well, it has to do also with the sounds that we use to produce those syllables. That's why it fits into this lecture. We, for example, have the word pi, monosyllabic word. Okay? I've got the phonemic transcription down here. And that is a one syllable, and this is the sign for a syllable. Okay. And the syllable actually consists of several parts. The onset and the rhyme. Okay. And in fact, the rhyme consists of the nucleus. The nucleus, you can sort of imagine, is the thing that you absolutely need. And the coda. If you're doing music, then you also know what a coda is, I guess. Right. So, you've got new terms. As I said, these are terms which will not be of prime importance. Okay. But they tie in with what I am saying. Okay. The nucleus, as I said, is the required element. This is different, well, it's slightly different, or it's realized in a different way in the word lay. What's different? We've got an onset, the first bit, the consonant. We've got the rhyme, but the nucleus is now split up in two parts, and there is no coda. This is as in C. Okay. Why is it like this? It's got a long vowel. It can get more complicated. We can have the word strives, one syllable. You can see that there is sort of a consonant cluster where we have a fairly complex onset. We then have a rhyme and we even have a branched nucleus and a coda. Okay, with a heavy nucleus and a coda present. Okay. And if we have words with, well, polysyllabic words, it could look like this. Where the rhyme does not branch. Now, if the rhyme does not branch, it means it's a light syllable. What's the opposite of a light syllable? Well, a heavy syllable. Sort of makes sense. Yeah? It's heavy if it branches, but it's also heavy if there is a coda. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Because it's got to do with things like stress, for example. How we stress words in English. This is something that you, as a foreign learner of English, sometimes have to learn. Where in the word is the primary stress, etc. Let's have a look at the words volcano, aroma, and potato, veranda, agenda, disaster, synopsis, cinema, avenue, and liberty. Why are they stressed like that? Why do I not say cinema or veranda? Well, there's a good reason for this. Again, this is something that I don't want you to learn by heart and apply, but there is a rule, and this is in a way almost like a random rule that I picked out to illustrate this, which is called the trisyllabic noun rule. What do we have here? We have nouns with three syllables. Can you work out the rule for stresses? For the stress? Because there are differences here in stress. Can you work that out? Given the time, and my hope that I still might let you go a few minutes earlier, I'm just going to tell you. Okay? If a syllable is, well, if the stress, no, okay. Why don't I just read what's there? It's been a long week. The stress is on the penultimate syllable. Do you know what a penultimate syllable is? It's the second last, okay? If the stress is there, if that syllable is heavy, then it's going to be stressed. The stress is on the antepenultimate, well, the one before the second, so the third last, okay, if the penultimate syllable is light. Okay? Cinema. Okay, this is a light syllable. There is no coda. It's not branching. Okay? It's not a long vowel. Okay? So the stress is on the third last syllable. Okay, I've colored it for you here. Okay? These are heavy syllables because there is a coda. These are heavy syllables because there's branching in the nucleus, because we have diphthongs. And in the third case, we have a syllable which is not heavy, and therefore the syllable before the one that's not heavy, namely the antepenultimate, is stressed. And now you can probably see how this all hangs together with sort of long vowels and short vowels and etc., etc. I already introduced you to the concept of closed and open syllables. In the open syllable, we have no coda. So in the volcano, K is an open syllable because there is no consonant at the end of the syllable. In fact, you could have a syllable with a single sound, which then by definition, of course, is the nucleus, awe. Okay? As in awe. I am in awe of this. If it's closed, it ends in one or several consonants. And you can look at the word, for example, splints, where we have, in fact, the whole consonant cluster in the onset and in the coda. And languages can do different things. Okay? There are different rules depending on which language you use. Now, the next slide, and I'll do this very quickly, is really only for those people who want to find out more. There are two additional principles. This is just to show you that there is more. Okay? There are two principles which come into play. The onset maximization principle and the sonority... The sonority sequencing principle. And this then decides where the syllable boundaries are. The fact that you don't need to learn it doesn't mean that you have to make noise. What do we have here? If we were to split things up into send and ing, then the onset of the second syllable is empty. That's not good. That's why it doesn't work like that. Sending doesn't work either, because N is more sonorous than D. So, if you have sen and ding, then both of those principles are applied. As I said, this is for people who are interested in phonetics and phonology, if you want to find out more. Which leads me to my last bit, which again is something that I would expect you to be able to deal with. Here is something which I once got from a student in Lancaster. Someone who speaks RP, like for example the Queen, would pronounce all their consonants at the end of words, whereas a Cockney from London would not. Is this really true? Well, I suggest we do listen to the Queen, because we would expect her to be a speaker of RP. Let's see whether I've got the sound right here. But this is the Queen in a speech that she gave just after her mother died. No, it wasn't that. Okay. Oh dear. I'm using a computer that I don't usually use because mine got conked up. Okay. I'll upload it to StudIP. It would have been nice if you had been able to hear it. But she says something like, country and the commonwealth, trials and sorrows, courage and service, warmth and affection, dedication and enthusiasm, etc. And when you listen to it online, listen to the question whether she, or not listen to the question, check whether she produces the D, the final D in and, or not. And you will see that in some cases she does, and in others she doesn't. Or it's barely audible. Okay? Why is this so? Because this is connected speech. If we were to ask the Queen what the coordinating conjunction is, if she knows a bit of linguistics, she would say, and. Okay? And she would say, and. Right? Okay? She might also say, but anyway. Yeah. But in connected speech, things happen that are not happening when we look at sort of the citation form, the form in isolation. Okay, you hear how she doesn't really say the end? Okay, thank you. Yeah. I have no idea why the second one worked and the first one didn't. But anyway, you got the point. Okay. Here's a little linguistic joke for you. I won't explain it, but it's got to do with connected speech. Okay? Okay, give me a chance to do the last six slides. In English, I said that certain things are possible, but other things are not. Certain combinations of sounds. Now that's true when we look at the, as I said, citation form. But in connected speech, some rather interesting things can happen. Okay. For example, the orthographic version here is, it is cold. Okay. And this is how we could transcribe it in a phonetic transcription. Okay. We've got, remember here, the is, because it's voiced rather than voiceless. Okay. And we've got the diphthong, it is cold. How would we say this in connected speech? Well, it's cold. Now, is not a sort of legal syllable in English. Yeah? Legal in the sense it does not correspond to the rules of syllable structure in English. One of the important reasons for this is assimilation. Okay. This is a very important process in connected speech. Okay. I'll give you a few more examples. That place. Okay. This is how we would transcribe it in citation form. What would happen in connected speech? Do you say that place? Are you discussing the benefits of assimilation or something else? Yeah, you too. Yes, you, exactly. Yeah, I mean you. Yeah. Yes. Okay, good. Good. Would you like to share what would happen with this then?
It's just wondering how it works.
Ah, okay. Okay, okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. I'll tell you. What would happen? We would have a case of assimilation of two consonants. Okay? That place, it's more difficult for the mouth to produce this, so if it's connected, it would actually result in two consonants, the two consonants actually sort of merging. Okay? That keen. You can see that the difference between, well, there's quite a distance between the way I produce that and okay, the tongue has to do something. And that's why we actually find that keen. That keen. Try to say that yourself. That keen. I'm not that keen on linguistics. I'm not that keen on whatever. Okay. Right. You don't say that keen. Okay. And in fact, you may say horseshoe rather than horse shoe. It's more difficult. So what exactly happens here? We have assimilation, but we have assimilation in the sense of the two consonants that are produced sort of merge in one place. We have an assimilation as in a place of articulation assimilation. That place, the two consonants are produced into different places. Versus that place where it's both bilabial. Okay. This is not necessarily the only way of doing things. We can also, that scene where the plosive actually becomes a fricative, that scene, okay, or good newspaper, where the d, the plosive actually sort of disappears. Okay. This is a manner of articulation assimilation. The place stays the same, but the manner changes. This is less frequent. And we can sometimes have an elision of a reduced vowel after a voiceless stop. Okay. Do we say potato? Potato. Potato. Or correct. Correct. Or cos. Cos. Okay. So we actually have originally a b, a voice B, which assimilates to a voiceless plosive because of the following consonant. And then we have the final, the word final dentals, like what the Queen has just produced. Okay. Last person. Last person. Okay. The T sort of gets elided. Or Fifth Street, which in fact becomes Fifth Street. Yeah. As I said, this is what the Queen did. In other Englishes, and this is not a mistake, I talk about different Englishes, this happens quite frequently. Let's see whether that works. This is from Singapore English, which is a variety of English which is in the process of becoming a native variety of English, where the majority of people speak only English at home. Let's see.
So generally, most of the areas that we visited were very, what you call it, rural. It's not town, it's actually very laid back.
Yeah. It's actually very laid back. It's not town, rather than town. This goes much further than what the Queen does, obviously, but it does go much further than what happens in British English.
It's not how, it's actually very laid-back.
Laid-back. It's not how. Yeah. Okay. In fact, there is a tendency to reduce consonant clusters. I've got the word exciting. I thought that was going to be an exciting word at the end of a lecture. Okay, how would a Singaporean, or many Singaporeans, produce the word exciting?
Exciting. Exciting.
Yeah? It's exciting. Exciting. Okay. You can see how a consonant cluster is reduced. Okay, final slide. Don't pack up yet. I know you are ready. Okay. Important points. You need to know the sounds of English and how they are produced. I will upload a list of all the sounds that English has with a full description. You just need to learn... Well, I wouldn't recommend learning the list by heart. You need to understand the system, and then you don't even need to learn the whole list by heart. You just need to know the difference between alveolar, velar, bilabial, labiodental, or something like that, and see how it connects. So, place and manner of articulation. You need to be able to read a broad phonetic transcription. You need to know and understand the difference between a phone and a phoneme. Okay. And you need to know that the difference between a phonetic transcription and a phonemic transcription is indicated with either square brackets or slashes. Okay. If you haven't understood the difference between phone and phoneme, for example, the tutorial might be a good idea. Okay. Or asking your neighbor outside the lecture. Okay. Or re-listening to the lecture. Coming to my office hour. Okay? You get the point. See you next Friday.